I'm Eric Peterson. I work in the kitchen. My last day was today. I leave tomorrow. Don't clap. And the session is called Fight Nuclear Weapons, Walk on the Grass. I wrote an article for an alternative newspaper we started up at school this spring. And I think what I'm going to do is begin the session by reading that, just giving a few short remarks, and then open it up for questions or discussion or comments or suggestions or anything. I'm always learning too. This is July 3. So I'd appreciate any challenges, any suggestions, anything. I'll just start by reading this. Fight nuclear weapons, walk on the grass. Several days ago, I sat on the grassy slope outside the administration building, basking in the sun. While I laid there, I watched two children playing on the concrete nearby. As the game got rougher, they moved towards a slope where there was a sign saying, "Keep off the grass." After the boy read the sign, his little sister turned to him, pulled on his sleeve, and said, "Then let's go to this other grass," pointing to the hill I sat on. Without further thought, they ran over and began to roll down the slope. It seems to me that those two children somehow realized how empty the "keep off the grass" sign really was. Somehow they recognized that grass is supposed to have little children playing on it, rolling in it, pulling it up and throwing at each other. They did not debate whether or not they would be punished, or what would happen if everyone played on the grass, or even what it would be like if there were no signs. Rather, they simply recognized the sign's falseness and continued to play on the grass. Unfortunately, such ability to see falseness as clearly as those children did is all too rarely encountered. Hence, many physicists who work on bomb projects maintain that they are simply doing physics, not building bombs. Many would actually argue that they are working for peace and are not the villains, for after all, it cannot be their responsibility how others use their knowledge. But this separation can only lead to disaster. Where does the responsibility then lie if the physicists are only doing physics, the factories are only providing needed jobs, the soldiers are only following orders, and our leaders, who will order the buttons pushed, are only defending the hopelessly ambiguous concept of national security? We must come to recognize that there cannot be a moral gap between action and intent. Why, if no one wants a nuclear war, do we continue to justify nuclear weapons in such static terms as nuclear deterrent, throw weight, missile survivability, and the window of vulnerability? As long as nuclear weapons remain in our arsenals, we are the ones who are vulnerable. And yet, we cannot agree to their elimination, because to do so, we absurdly reason, would threaten our security and stability. We reduce the bombs that destroy people, the seeds of our destruction, to numbers that must be bartered and argued over as if they were points on a test. We have thrust nuclear weapons, having once emerged from the obscurity of scientific theory and government secrecy after destroying Hiroshima and Nagasaki, into the obscurity of the sterile, denatured world of professional think tanks, paid to dream the undreamable, which we lack the will to face. Even many anti-nuclear activists fall into the trap of hiding from the full meaning of nuclear weapons. I was disturbed about a year ago when a friend confided in me that because the nuclear question was so threatening, there simply wasn't time to develop a relationship with a girl he liked. This attitude is not uncommon. Eliminating nuclear weapons often becomes the most important question, usurping all other concerns and activities. Faced with the possibility of extinction, some activists are driven by fear in their actions. Their lives become cloaked in such darkness and fear that it seems inappropriate to go on vacation, to lounge in the woods, or have babies. Like my friend, some activists become so obsessed with fighting the bomb that they lose sight of what they are fighting for. Although I believe it is not conscious, many come to love an abstract mankind more than individual people. Simple politics, like ignorance, is not the solution to our nuclear dilemma. Nuclear weapons reach far beyond traditional politics. We have created atomic knowledge which we cannot now forget. As in Dürrenmatt's play The Physicists, A thought once thought cannot be unthought. Political solutions are necessarily short-term measures designed to buy time, far too unstable to ultimately solve the nuclear problem. This is not to imply that we should not undertake political actions to limit, halt, and reverse the arms race, just as there should be no argument between one doctor who wants to give a sedative to relieve a gravely ill patient's pain and another doctor who wants surgery to correct the ailment. The problem arises only when one claims the sedative is all that is necessary. The tragedy of the physicists and the anti-nuclear activists I described is essentially the same. Certainly one is dedicated to producing bombs and the other to destroying them, but both are lost to a real understanding of responsibility. Nuclear weapons do not somehow stand apart from our world. They were dreamed up and produced by us. They are our problem. They hold within their shells our potential extinction. We cannot pretend to be innocent and ignore them. Each of us holds some responsibility for their presence. The physicist who states he is simply doing physics and not making bombs separates himself from our collective responsibility to preserve humankind. The activist who accepts the exclusive sovereignty of the nuclear question separates himself from the responsibility and joy of sharing in life. Both maintain faith in an abstract realm outside human responsibility and experience. We cannot continue this abstraction. We will only be able to stop our self-annihilation if we are able to recognize the bomb in relation to our collective human experience, outside questions of mere political utility. We must recognize the peril that faces us, yet not bow to fear. Life is too precious to be squandered in either war or hysteria. And in recognizing the complete immorality of nuclear weapons, we can then act. We must, like the children playing on the grass, see through the false security of nuclear weapons and refuse to participate in their justification. Only by living our lives in antithesis to the immorality of nuclear weapons can we ever hope to be free of their threat. We must immerse ourselves in the goodness of life, taking spring walks, making love, and living with all of its dancing, singing, and crying. Only grounded in the seed of life can political action hope to succeed in freeing us from the threat of nuclear extinction.
Amen.
Basically, and I'm just going to say a real short thing here. Nuclear weapons to me represent everything of death. It represents death. To me, the strongest statement that you can make against nuclear weapons is to live, and to live life to its fullest, to put your faith in life, and to put your faith in love. And that is the statement against nuclear weapons, and that's our only hope. And it means the only way that nuclear weapons will ever be eliminated is if a choice is provided. And I see that it's our responsibility to make our lives that choice. There's problems both with the people who make the bombs and the people who are fighting against the bombs, and with myself, who still doesn't have the courage yet to live my life against the bombs. And I think that this is what I want to talk about, is making that choice. Or anything else? Say good morning.
When you say you haven't had the courage to fight against the bomb, I mean, what do you mean by that? What would it involve to be against the bomb? Can you just say, I am?
I think that what it requires is to live a Christ-like life. And that takes a lot of guts. And it takes a lot of saying no to a lot of things. And I don't say no to a lot of things yet. I still have a friend who hurts, and I go on a hike instead of talking. And I still drink my morning cup of coffee, though I'm trying to stop, even though I know that represents Colombian workers being put into poverty, just because I can't say no to a cup of coffee. And I'd say no to things that I don't have the courage yet to say, and that's what has to be said. And it has to be a set. You have to say yes to life. You have to say yes to Christ's example of love. It means risking an awful lot in faith.
One thing that comes to my mind is that in providing the choice that Eric's talking about, it seems that's not a choice that's based on having a long enough list of reasons. See, to get a list of reasons and rationalizations is to play the game that politicians play, and that's an abstract game. Is to think of mental reasons why I should do something or why I shouldn't do something. And you can have pros and cons, and simply if you get a longer list of pros on one side, then you do that. But if someone comes along and presents another set of examples on the other side, well, then you can switch sides and have no sense of moral guilt or shame or anything. But providing a choice is trying to discern. And this is where it gets real hard, because it's real vague and it's real ambiguous and it's not rational all the time, is to make a decision for something which is more of an act of volition, which is not based on having a set of reasons for it. And so a lot of times you can't convince someone or argue this out with someone, because it's not so often reasons.
Oh yeah, I agree.
It's just, doing it with your life and actions. And that's hard to do, because it's sometimes irrational. It's below that level of consciousness, which is very easy to deal on, because it's very abstract, it's very divorced from the messy issues of feelings and morality. So that's why it's real hard to do.
I guess I see nuclear weapons as not being primarily a political question. I think it's a question, a faith question, political questions. Say they make a choice based on a whole variety of things, notwithstanding a substantial support behind your position, and you make a decision oftentimes on that rationale, on the lesser of two evils. And I guess what I see nuclear weapons, as long as we continue addressing nuclear weapons in that respect, we're going to continue to kill ourselves. And what I think it is going to take is it's going to take us just saying no. And there's a lot of questions there. Like, one that I'm facing right now is I'm about ready to enter the real world after that world of school, where you don't worry about things like jobs and things is whether or not you pay war taxes. Do you pay for those bombs even though you say you're against them? I don't know. I registered for the draft. Now I regret it, but that's something you have to deal with too, is do you support it? And it takes a lot of guts. And I think of, I don't know how many people saw the forum on that the Narns did about Telemachus. And also I think of, and the way he stood, I'll just briefly, I looked this up to get the story straight, yeah. And just for those who didn't see it, Telemachus was a monk in 400 AD or thereabouts. And in Christian Rome, they still had the gladiatorial fights. One day, as the gladiators came out and they drew their swords and they were about ready to start combating, Telemachus ran out between them with his cross and shouted, "Stop in the name of our master. Stop fighting." And the crowd beat him to death. And then they looked and they saw what they did. and they walked out, and the emperor walked out, and that was the last gladiatorial fight in Rome. He wasn't a politician. He didn't form committees and think, well, if I get enough support, I won't fight. I can't do anything about these gladiatorial fights until I get enough support, until I get a majority of people, and we can convince the emperor to stop it. Rather, he saw the need and put ultimately, our ultimate power is our lives and faith. And he put that up on the line, he got killed. But that's the kind of cuts you're talking about. I'm not ready for that.
Eric, to use that as an example of something that changed policy or reality in a political way, I mean, the emperor after that was the one that made the decision. What would you see as parallels now running out with our crosses that will eventually affect decision making? Because you say you don't think it's a political question, but ultimately there has to be a mandate to tear a bomb apart or whatever to stop production that is political.
Yeah. I think that one of the simplest things is we have to stop being afraid of saying what we think and what we believe because we're afraid that other people won't like us. I think that we have to live our lives as a choice. I think that we can make peace amongst ourselves, which is a lot more difficult than making peace among nations in your mind. I wish I would have brought the poem along that Ross read in the lift the other night about loving thy neighbor. Not that particular neighbor, you know. That son of a bitch. And refusing to participate when the government tells you to participate in something you think is immoral, something you think is not peacemaking. And that's a tough one.
It seems to be, to me, that to be consistent with the children playing on the grass, that maybe we need to learn to say yes instead of no.
Say yes to?
To opening up our homes to people. By making yourself vulnerable to all kinds of rejection, just in the simple act of hugging your neighbor. I think we sometimes want to make it so complicated that it gets beyond the realm of possibility. I can't imagine stopping all of this in one act of any kind.
It's illegal to pick up a hitchhiker in some places. You know, that's kind of strikes me. Tried to know the fellow between the eyes. I've helped a lot. I've been helped, and I expect it to continue going both ways. You know, and it's the legal statement in writing, in braille, if you will, on the highway sign. And then you go to church and have a dialogue with the old people or friends. Where did I lose the image of Christ at?
Yeah. It's a big difference between doing what's good and doing what's right. Doing what's right is, you know, the more political question of having reasons. And then you weigh the right and wrong, and you weigh this and that, and then you find out at the end that this is right. And doing what's good is something, I think, that you perceive immediately. You know it's good to help someone, to pick them up on the road, to give someone who needs food. Those are the things that you know. And sometimes it's illegal to give people food. Like if they're an El Salvadorian refugee, it's illegal to even give them directions how to get to the bus station.
But it's like Eric said, it takes a risk.
Yeah, it takes a risk to say no to what's right in some cases and yes to what's good.
The other thing that when you said we lose Christ's image, the thought that struck me, and it has always bothered me too, because my dad's a minister, and so I've been around churches all my life, is that, and it struck me one Sunday several years ago when we read the passage, when Lord did we see you hungry and did not drink, when did you, without shelter. Then we all left at 12 o'clock and locked the doors of the church because we were afraid that if we let people sleep there, things would get stolen or vandalized. Mm-hmm. And that just really struck me as that is that separation where you're just scared and there's somewhere where you just have to say, I have faith in something greater.
Or accept the inevitability of the vandalization.
That's right. So somebody scars the carpet or wrecks the altar. To me, is very trivial compared to giving somebody a place to sleep.
There are several groups of people in San Francisco who are peacemakers on a very local and immediate level called community boards. And the community boards are made up of volunteer people of all walks of life, and I mean including illiterates, newly to the city. We have a lot, I live in San Francisco, so we have a lot of people coming in from Vietnam and from Samoa and the South Pacific, and just from all over. And the community boards is set up to act as a buffer between the police department, the courts, and the citizens. You and I have a beef. Your dog is keeping me awake all night. And I'm sick of it. And I start throwing rocks at the dog. I mean, these are actual cases, okay? And I hit the dog. The owner sees me hit the dog with the rock. He throws a rock back at me. Pretty soon, you've got a war on your hands. The first inclination is to call police. Okay, you call the local police in my neighborhood, which is about 8 or 10 blocks away. And the police department calls up the community boards, the chairman in that particular neighborhood. And they say, we've got these two parties. See what you can do. So we get in touch with the two parties and we try to bring them together. Call them in separately first. What's the beef? What's happening? And then after we listen to both sides separately, we try to get them in together and have them face each other and deal with it right then and there. In more cases than not, it's settled. And if not in an amicable way, at least in a way that's tolerated. And sometimes it can get pretty hairy because anger is very real right now. I mean, people are really angry. Unemployment is an incredible rate. The cutbacks in city government. So that's one way of saying yes. I'll give up 6 hours a month. You have things like that where you come from. Maybe they do. If they don't, maybe you can get them started.
I was going to ask, how do you see this kind of despair widespread, like you mentioned in your paper about a friend who broke a relationship with a woman?
Yeah.
Kind of.
I see it the several years that I've been involved in the peace movement, I see it. I see it quite prevalent. I see it a lot. A lot, especially a couple of years ago, I saw it so strongly in myself. And I could have been talking about myself as far as the relationship with a girl was concerned. Yeah, I see that. I see it as being strong. Do you see it as being strong? You who are active? That kind of stuff? Or just see it around in your friends?
I'm not very active in the peace movement, and I'm sorry about that. But I do know somebody, the person I know who has the littlest faith in God that I know is an atheist, and he has the most fear of anybody I know. And he has taken great measures to make himself an expert on the arms race, and he's against nuclear disarmament, and he's just surrounded by this paranoia. And I'm just, when you mention faith, I'm just so sure it's because he has just no faith. He has built himself a bomb shelter, he has a year's supply of food, he has just incredible plans, and he just lives in constant fear. So that's,
I see a lot of despair in people outside the peace movement. I mean, lots of it. Just so deeply felt that they don't even see it as despair to say, well, anybody feel that way. But within the peace movement, I see quite a bit of hope. I think there's... I wasn't really involved in the 60s, but I almost feel like this peace movement is more faith-based than some of the activity then. I'm kind of curious if anybody else has an opinion on that, but this just feels so strongly church-led. I was talking to a friend or an acquaintance, and she was not a Christian. In fact, went out of her way to say she wasn't, because Christianity has such a bad name with a lot of people. But then she said, but there are some good people. She said, I was at the Point Julia thing. She says, 90% of the people there are church. She says, I think that gives us some hope. So I think that's maybe why it's different this time. I could be wrong. I think in the 60s it was more anger than fear. And I think now there's more people working from hope.
Also, what I've both read and observed in talking to campus pastors that it's your age group, college age, that are the most absent from the peace movement. There's this underlying despair, but it's numbness, and I just want to see if you agree with this, kind of just a frantic thinking only about getting into the system and getting a job.
I agree. And
when you see the peace movement, you're seeing middle-aged people, you're seeing church people, but the absence of people in their 20s is, I think, is astounding.
Especially since that's the natural constituency. Mm-hmm.
But I think there are getting to be more people in their teens. Just in the last 2 or 3 years, I think there's starting up a crop of people that are past... Well, they see the reality, but they also maybe see some of the hope. Whereas, as you say, your age just saw the despair.
I think part of that is because the middle-aged people have a broader base that they come to peace issues from. The people that are in college, I think, especially just that age group, there's so much in the environment that you're caught up in a college setting that is analytical, that unless it's taught in an analytical way, it's addressed with an attitude of cynicism, or it's just inevitable, because I don't think we're providing 20-year-olds with a lot of other points of reference to come at it. If you don't get a college class on nuclear proliferation or a poli-sci class on international conflict, and even if you do, it's pretty analytical.
That you're faced with is that the kind of choice that you make in your life, the faith in Christ's example, it's non-programmatic. You can't, you don't program that, you don't. And therefore, like Paul, you said, you don't argue it either. I mean, it's not something, you can't just get the right argument so everybody believes you, you know?
That's proper.
Because that's what they're doing in Congress right now a lot of times, is they're looking for that key so they can convince the senators to vote on this. But I have faith in the Pentagon that they have a lot of bright young upstarts over there that can just think of a clever argument against it. It has to be a completely different choice. A completely new alternative. It can't, it's not a slick argument. And it's not analytical, and it's not programmatic. And that's my basis for saying that it's not really a political question, because political questions aren't programmatic. Mm.
It's also substantiates what you said about being Christ-like. Because Christ's actions were not, and in his words, in his reason, he didn't get to a big argument for his reasons. He wasn't operating out of that frame of mind.
I think you have to remember too that it doesn't all come at one time. It comes in steps. And not to lay a guilt trip on yourself, you don't have it all at once. Because I know for me it's coming step by step, where I'm ready for civil disobedience now. And I wouldn't have been last spring, I wasn't. And so it's something, you know, with nonviolence or whatever. You know, 2 years ago, if someone had broke into my home, I probably would have, and tried to kill me, I would have really thought, well, it's okay maybe to kill them because I'm defending myself. And I wouldn't do that anymore. I would take the chance of hopefully not getting killed or whatever. So it's step by step that it comes.
And it's slow, and it's painful. And you always want to do better.
When Barb and I were up here we were here for a year in 1978-79. We had to rent our house out in order to make the payments, mortgage. And about 2 weeks after we were in the village, we received communication from the real estate agent that he wasn't going to handle the account anymore because the people weren't going to pay the rent. So I went into a tizzy for a while. What am I going to do? I couldn't phone out. I couldn't, you know, in the wintertime up here, 3 boats a week. And the mailboat wouldn't even go out until 2 days later. So I went to John, talked to him about it, went to Jansen, talked to him about it, and finally realized there wasn't a darn thing I could do about it. Even if I went to San Francisco, what am I going to do about it? And if they're not going to pay, they're not going to pay. I'm not going to go there with a gun. So I just kind of forgot about it for the time being. And of course they didn't pay the rent, and they left the house and vandalized it and stole most of anything of any value. Well, what am I going to do now? And I thought a really radical thought occurred to me. Why not try it? I put a $20 bill in the envelope and mailed it to them. And I said, you must need help, and I want to help. How can I help you? And it turned out that there was a couple of two different nationalities, one leaving the other. The woman left with 2 kids and no means of support. She couldn't pay the rent. There was no way she could pay it. She couldn't, it's just impossible. The vandalism occurred because of not intentional vandalism, but because they didn't know how to live in a house because I never lived in a house before. We assume everyone knows how to live in a house. And the thievery occurred when these two adults were bickering and arguing, and the guy was stealing stuff in order to support a dope habit. So anyway, we corresponded for almost 3 years. Sent money regularly, clothing for the kids, and it just turned the whole thing around. It turned it around for me because I no longer ate my insides out over it. There wasn't anything I could do anyhow. And once I got rid of that initial anger, and it did happen, I was boiling. It created some marvelous things. And we really got rid of a lot of junk we didn't want anymore. And that's really true. That's honest to God true. It really is. And I had a brother-in-law who was able to pick up the pieces kind of without us being there, and rented it to a neat guy who made hang gliders. I mean, that's radical, you know. If anyone would suggest that to me, I'd say you're nuts, man.
Dan, what did you call that the other night? Overpowering through love, but you use...
Oh, yeah, it's Gandhi's word.
Yes.
Satyagraha.
Satyagraha.
Really works.
I found out it not only works, it's almost a necessity in my life. Because it's a lot harder for me to hate somebody than it is to love them.
Oh, so destructive to yourself.
I heard you yelling at those chipmunks before.
I love them now, though.
Barbecued.
Even. Do you even love the people who put tin foil on your compost?
Diapers without plastic bags. That's my spiritual battle.
It's your cross to bear. Feel the splinters.
Is that an attitude or a way of thinking that you try to teach in your, that you try to pass on in your teaching deck?
Oh yeah. Of course. Steal my jelly beans. Here, I'll give you my M&Ms. Mm-hmm.
It's
not easy to do, let me tell you. Because boy, oh boy, I really want those jelly beans.
That's such a powerful attitude. How can we use that with our national problem?
What is that?
That this attitude we're talking about is such a powerful thing. Can we use that in our national, international problems?
Well, what you can do is you can use it in your life, and I think that that's where the change is going to occur.
We could all forgive Reagan.
That's one thing I've been struggling with.
A mass movement to forgive him.
That's something I've really been struggling with when you said that. Mm-hmm. All I do is I rant and rave about the guy. I mean, I just fill out every frustration I have in my body on Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, that's something that's really important in whatever political dealings we have. We can use that same power in a political situation so that you don't create an adversarial situation. You know, I go talk to my congressman, I could get really upset at a lot of his policies, but I just keep working with him, trying to figure out what makes him tick and why he's that way, and let him know that I don't bear him any grudge, but, and it's just a continuing educational thing.
But you can never let him off the hook either, and you can never let yourself off the hook, because you always have to, there again, it's my belief, you have to be a choice. And that's going to rub raw nerves too. Mm-hmm. And if nobody gets angry, you do have to start thinking of, either you're incredibly, you know, charismatic, or you have to. And that's what's tough for me, is that a lot of times I don't want to raise waves. I got this incredible fear of, I mean, I don't mind doing crazy, weird stuff, but when it's somebody I love, like my parents, mm-hmm. telling them I don't think they're doing something right, and saying I'm going to do something even though, because I think it's right, I know it's right, even though you disagree vehemently with me, and to watch the pain in their eyes, rather than just saying, well, I'll let it slide by. I don't want to hurt them. They're too old to change.
Yeah, I'd argue that.
That's what I argue. You say, well, they're too old to change, so I'm not going to raise any stink. I'm not going to stand up for what I think. I'll just let it slide by. And that's a bunch of bullshit. It really is.
So how do you handle their hurt in their...
I don't do it very well. I try. I have two parents that love me dearly. That helps a lot.
It seems to me that a lot of the reason for the nuclear proliferation is that we've defined an enemy, and maybe what we really have to work at is redefining our life without enemies. Mm-hmm. Do we need to have an enemy? Does Ronald Reagan have to be our enemy?
Right.
Mm-hmm. What's the purpose of having enemies? I think one of the greatest things we can do if we want to do something to in a global way is to promote in whatever way we can, for example, foreign exchange student programs with Russia. Both ways.
Mm-hmm.
One of the greatest assets that we've had in this country, in that way, in a small way, has been the exchange of astronauts through NASA. It seems little, and many people don't even know that's happened. But to some degree, in the scientific level, it's helped a great deal.
Exactly. That's why do we need enemies? I think the reason why we have enemies is because it takes responsibility off of us.
Mm-hmm.
It's no longer my fault that people are poor. I happen to be quite wealthy compared to most people. It's not my problem with their poor. It's Ronald Reagan's problem because he's cutting programs. Therefore, I don't need to change. It's Ronald Reagan that needs to change.
Mm-hmm. Do other people here feel that anger is almost always an outgrowth of fear?
Yes.
I've got a book sitting on my table and I haven't read it yet. I brought it along this week to hopefully get into it. But it's by Frankie Schaefer, son of Francis Schaefer. And one of his first books that I read was Addicted to Mediocrity, which I think is most Americans should read. But this one is A Time for Anger. And he's saying that it's a time frame. And he's apparently just reading the preface and stuff. And built on his last book, that complacency only leads to a dead end itself.
I think you should be always passionate.
Passionate or compassionate?
Passionate.
Passionate.
And I think that anger is... I think it's natural, and I think that it may be out of fear. I don't know what it is out of, but I just know that happens.
I think part of anger is this philosophy of a win-lose situation, where someone has wronged you and you lose, and now you need a. Your philosophy says that you have to win. You have to get back at the other person, and that's what our foreign policy is based on is just a win-lose philosophy.
If we look at anger and let ourselves learn again from the children on the grass, the children the children who are really angry are those children who really haven't been given the strokes and don't have a positive self-esteem and a sense of self-worth. So in one respect, maybe if we have a positive self-esteem and self-worth based in our faith, we'll approach Ronald Reagan with an attitude other than just anger.
Yeah.
How do you do that? How do you do that?
How do you do that?
I would say you do it by accepting the responsibility you throw on him, on yourself.
But I mean, how do you build self-esteem?
How do you build self-esteem? I think one way is to treat people as people. That sounds real simple. Mm-hmm. I think it also happens, maybe be true.
You gotta start treating yourself.
Yeah, start treating yourself.
Yeah. And I see anger coming out from being hurt.
You notice that in me?
I wasn't referring to you, but I really, this is when I get angry, it's because I've been hurt inside or something. And when my self-esteem is up, I don't get hurt as easily. And so then I can walk away from the thing and just say, well, okay.
Well, sometimes, I don't know what the feelings on anger are that are floating around here, but I think sometimes anger is natural and necessary, and we need to understand it and deal with it. And not say, oh, anger is bad, you've got to be nice. Because there are times when you really have to just say, this is really stupid, or this is really wrong, and I'm not going to have anything to do with it, and just get very angry and change something.
But find out what's causing it and deal with
it. Well, you got to know, you also have to know what to fight for. What are you going to spend your time doing? Because you can get angry about a lot of things and you can just get paralyzed by that anger. But to somehow say, look, it's not going to do me any good to get mad that people vandalized my home or took stuff. I mean, how can I deal with this? There may be some time when you just have to make a decision to just go with that anger and do something.
I think anger, like love, is one of those words that's hard to define right
now. Yeah,
because I would say the monk that you mentioned of the 4th century was not angry. The crowd was angry. Usually, it seems to me that most of the time, anger hurts us more than the person we're striking out at in anger toward. So, in any position, you have to decide whether that how much is it worth being angry compared to the damage it's going to do to you as a person?
Yeah. Let me get an example for me. If I said in the arms races, you can see how after the Second World War, a decision was made in this country to continue a military economy just to keep everybody's jobs, and then how this demanded a tremendous PR effort to make afraid of the Soviet Union, especially at budget time. And you can just see how these powers just kind of took over. And this is the biggest snow job probably in the history of the world. Mm-hmm. And then when I think even today of all of the people that benefit personally from this, I suppose including all of us somewhat. And then this thing continues and continues and continues, largely because so many people benefit from it. And then the PR effort continues. I just get mad. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you handle it? You know, and I respond to it. You know, my response to it, I think, has been fairly constructive. It's to study the way of peace and speak the truth as often as I can. Have a faith that somehow the truth power will eventually conquer. But a lot of times I just get angry at the whole thing. I wonder how do you deal with it?
One of the things that benefits of living here for a year and a half is when we went home, we start to laugh at TV commercials. They really used to make us angry.
Yeah.
Now we just sit there and laugh.
Really?
Can you laugh at the Pentagon?
No.
You haven't gotten it?
I haven't gotten that far. They haven't had a commercial on TV yet. Maybe if they did it.
You know, I think the way I've dealt with this, I was just thinking, I don't feel that I get mad, angry, whatever, very much at all. But I am passionately, absolutely and totally and completely opposed to the garbage that's going on in the way of arms race, economics, and just about everything else.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, okay, I don't have anger. What do I have that makes it work? And maybe it is anger, but it's not anger at the people. I really, the images that Dan keeps talking about of the powers and principalities, I really feel that. When I look at Reagan, you know why I can't be mad at him? I think he's pathetic. I think he's just this sad, scared, pathetic person who's in the wrong place at the wrong time and doesn't have the faintest idea what to do. And I'm not saying that even in a patronizing way. Almost anybody that would get to that spot would be the same. I can't be mad at Ronald Reagan. I can be madder than hell at the powers that are messing up this world, including him and the world that he's helping to shape. But I think that maybe that's a saving thing for me, is that every single person that I see do something bad, I can come up with a reason why they did it, and then I can be mad at the reason. See the difference? That has freed me a lot.
It's tough to make that separation.
Well, for me it isn't. I mean, I've been fortunate. I feel very graced. I very much feel graced that I can do this.
One thing that comes to my mind is that it seems a lot of times when we get really angry at something, it's because we've placed all our hope in that. Like if we place all our hope in having the right person as president,
right,
or having getting rid of nuclear weapons, or having this such and such happen, if that is going to determine whether or not our life has meaning, then we can get very angry at that something not happening. But that, whether or not we get rid of nuclear weapons, or Reagan gets elected for life, or death, or whatever, that has no power over whether or not my life has meaning, and whether or not I can live my life in a good way. So once you realize that, it just is water rolling off the back. And you can deal with that. It's not that you ignore it, or turn your back on it, or don't deal with it. You're still concerned, you still get involved in politics, but you do it from a position that does not place ultimate meaning in it. You realize it for what it is, and then you can have a separation to laugh at it if need be, and there can be a separation from that.
It's a position of not letting this all rule your own life, mm-hmm, but wanting to stand up for it, for what we have here and what we'd like to enjoy at least while we're here on earth.
Yeah,
like we talked about hope the other night, Holly, you brought up the point at the forum, saying that the hope that we do have hope, because we have life after death. And what we are here now on earth, and it's an insignificant life compared to what's ahead. And we have to work hard, though, while we're here to preserve what we have and enjoy what we have, because God gave us this beautiful earth to enjoy and take care of.
Anger is still a viable topic. I just got one other thought about it. I've discovered in my life that anger comes from not dealing with something. And that I actually had to learn how to get angry for years. I just bottled stuff up and I was really mad at everybody all the time and I just never expressed it. And then I had some counseling and the guy started training me how to get mad. And instead of waiting 5 days and discussing it intellectually, then you'd say 3 days later that you'd been mad and so on. And I worked it down to the point where somebody would do something that I thought was uncalled for and I'd say, you didn't really need to do that. I didn't like that. And I could say it immediately. And there wasn't any anger and there wasn't any buildup and there wasn't any anything. They'd say, I'm sorry, and they'd quit doing it. Or they'd say, that's what I want to do. But it took the pressure off. I mean, that sounds kind of simple-minded, but I think that it's given me a lot of peace of mind to say, you don't have, anger is something you get when you don't deal with something. If you do deal with it, if you just go to the person or work on the situation, even if you can't solve it, if you're doing something about it, as soon as you possibly can, there isn't any tension built up.
No, it's 4:58, so my last closing comment is that I'm so happy that we spent an hour talking about nuclear weapons and didn't get grounded in, but what if the Russians?
Amen. So,
thank you.
Depression.
Go in peace.
So,
thanks be to God.
Brother.